outside.
My name is Craig Harper. I'm a lecturer in human psychology here in the UK. I do research on controversial decision making, so things like political decision making, views about crime. Most of my research has been focused around attitudes towards sexual offenders, specifically those who have paedophilic sexual interests. I teach on those topics as well, so I teach on topics including psychology of sex offending, explanations of crime, critical thinking in forensic psychology. And I've got an emerging interest in political polarization and this idea of liberals and conservatives being equivalent in certain constructs like authoritarianism and science denial when it's something that disagrees with their side of an argument.
Would you be okay, and I think this is a perfectly reasonable question, is what kind of got you into this area of research?
Good question. To be honest, it was my undergraduate research project. So basically, I was paired with a researcher, and essentially it was his area of research. So that was kind of the direction that I went in for my undergraduate honours dissertation. And really, it's just an area of research that I've continued to be engaged with ever since. That was getting on for about 8 years ago now. So I started off looking at basically, do different groups of undergraduates have different attitudes towards sexual offenders, and then moved on to look at what are the drivers of attitudes towards sexual offenders in society. So we looked a lot at kind of media representations, and that eventually morphed into my PhD thesis, which looked at kind of what's the psychology that underpins some of the ways that we make decisions about sexual crime and sexual offenders. So really quite an organic kind of research-driven approach, in no personal anecdote, I'm afraid.
That's probably for the best.
But probably for the best, yeah.
So when you first began looking at this area, what was it like for you to be researching such a controversial and difficult area to explore?
To be honest, I've never really had too much of an emotional response to the research. So obviously everyone has the emotional response to sexual offending. It's a natural thing to emotionally respond to. But my core kind of idea that underpins all of my research is, what is the contribution that I can make through the research? So if I can help to understand why we make decisions about sexual offenders, why we make certain kind of snap emotional judgments, potentially then I can have a role in, I don't know, facilitating some kind of more effective way of talking about this issue. So my kind of overarching feeling is that actually from a scientific and a psychological perspective, we make a lot of our political decisions based on emotion rather than the evidence. And this is something that is spoken about by a few researchers in this area. So James Cantor talks about this quite a lot. And what my role is, I see in research, is basically to help us to understand what are the psychological mechanisms that underpin these attitudes and these opinions, and can we then use them mechanisms to help us to, I don't know, have a more reasoned and a more rational conversation about how to best reduce the incidence of sexual offending.
Why do you think other people have such a negative reaction to when you either bring this up or they're talking about it?
Well, I mean, sex is one of those topics anyway that people don't tend to like to talk about, especially in the UK, as you're probably aware. But sexual offending and the impact that it has on victims, I think we're just programmed to have these harsh emotional responses. So there's a team of researchers that have termed the response that we have as moral outrage. So these things like fear, disgust, loathing and anger towards offenders. These are natural kind of inbuilt moral, I suppose, reactions that we have. And I've done some work on the moral foundations theory and how that links to our responses to particularly child sexual abuse. So I wrote a paper last year with Andrew Harris, who's at the University of Massachusetts. And what we were looking at was basically, are there certain modules of our morality, our moral makeup, that can predict how we make judgments about different types of sexual offenders? And we've got a fairly comprehensive database that we're still kind of working through. And it seems to be suggesting that there are certain aspects of our morality that that drive those views. Obviously, we have these automatic responses to a whole range of things. We use heuristics as kind of mental shortcuts for making decisions every day. And I don't think sexual crime is any different. It just taps into another one of those moral impulses that we have.
And do you think one of those moral outrages in particular applies to the sexual offences towards children? Because obviously that, I would imagine that must be one of the highest knee-jerk response, extreme outrage towards, as far as offences go.
Absolutely, yeah. So if we just work through a couple of the moral foundations, so you've got care, or care harm, as it might be conceptualised by people like Jonathan Haidt. So it's basically this inbuilt response or inbuilt need or drive that we have to protect people at the bottom of society. So typically, from an evolutionary perspective, this is typically based around our responses to children. We look after children, we care for them, we protect them from harm. If people are high on that foundation, we typically see quite harsh responses to sexual offenders. But also the idea of purity. Purity is another one of these moral foundations where if something is perceived as being unnatural or obviously not pure, we see these very harsh responses. And I think that the idea of paedophilia generally, but the offence of child sexual abuse really hits on those two moral foundations quite hard, I suppose.
Yeah. And do you think that's why people have such an extreme reaction to them over, say, adult sexual offence?
I think so, yeah. It's really difficult to parse the difference between responses to child sexual offences and sexual offences against adults. Purely because the sexual offences against adults is so politicised. So we're living through times where there's accusations of rape culture, there's obviously talk of the patriarchy, which I'm sure we'll get onto later on. But those kinds of arguments don't tend to be present in debates about child sexual offending. What we tend to assume is that all sexual offenders against children are just, for want of a better word, perverts who have paedophilic sexual interest, or we call them paedophiles, irrespective of whether or not they do have that sexual interest. It's much more of a clear kind of cut response to child sexual offences rather than adult offences.
In a way, it sounds like, you know, the idea of sexual offence towards children is considered basically evil by most people, and pretty much, as you said, such a black and white topic. It's evil, and therefore, what's there to talk about? What's there to research? It's just evil. Let's move on to other things.
Yeah. So there's this idea as well of implicit theories. So people have certain implicit theories about the causes of behaviour. So I did some work last year with my former PhD supervisor. We were looking at whether people have what's called an entity-based implicit theory, where a behaviour or a trait is seen as being ingrained and not amenable to change, versus if they have an incremental implicit theory of behaviour, which is more an approach where you see behaviour as something that can change over time. And what we found was that those who hold particularly fixed stereotypes about who child sexual offenders are, so this kind of predatory adult male, they tend to have much more punitive responses to sexual offences, much more negative attitudes towards sexual offenders generally, than those who have more of an incremental implicit theory. It's this idea of child sexual offenders being perceived as just evil to the core, I think does have some empirical credibility. I think there is something to be said about that.
Right. I think something I'll ask you in a minute, which is important, is that distinction between paedophilia and sexual offender. And I think you probably get, from the layman, quite a lot of flack for making that. Just quickly, you mentioned evolutionary psychology. Do you feel like in this realm of research that evolutionary psychology is an approach you can utilise to better understand it, or do you think it's more of a social psychological phenomenon?
In terms of the causes of offending, I'm not sure, and I'm by no means an expert in evolutionary psychology, so I don't want to overstep my kind of expertise, but in terms of an evolutionary approach, I know that there have been some efforts to explain sexual offending against adults, particularly rape, using an evolutionary approach. So Craig Palmer and Randy Thornhill, they put together their book in, I think it was 2000, called The Natural History of Rape. And essentially what they were saying was that rape has something to do with sex. So it gets beyond this kind of standard social science approach to understanding rape, where everything's viewed in terms of the lens of power and dominance. I think there's something to be said about that argument. I think there's clearly something going on in terms of adults, offending against adults, that has some kind of evolutionary or some kind of sexual element to it. So you see that the average age of rape victims, for example, is an age where fertility is well, where conception is possible. Even among those who offend against those who are below the age of consent, the average age of the victim is around 14. So again, there's potential for conception. I think there's less of an argument to be made about an evolutionary approach to child sexual offending. I don't see particularly where that would fit or how you would explain child sexual offending using an evolutionary approach. But again, that might be a symbol or a symptom of my ignorance of evolutionary psychology. In terms of responses, though, I think there's definitely something to be made in terms of shunning those who are essentially getting things in an unfair way. So this idea of a free rider, maybe, who gets sexual gratification, gets sexual activity, who is able to, for want of a better phrase, spread his seed in a way that is not by the standard ways that you would do it. So I think there might be something there. Again, it's something that researchers really could look at quite simply, but I don't think people have really thought in too much depth about what is the psychology of attitudes and responses to sexual offending.
I think it's an interesting point because, you know, we have different cultures and societies that have different viewpoints on what age is okay to consent and to have sex. And so therefore, I guess it is interesting to note, if it is a social psychological phenomenon, then how come it would be different across communities and cultures, and therefore is there an evolutionary perspective to understanding our motivations towards sex with people to a certain age group, and where does it become offence in our eyes, and is that based on the community that we grew up in, or is that like an evolutionary instinctive knowledge?
Yeah, well, I suppose it's what we classify as an offence is clearly socially driven, socially determined by the laws that we have. In terms of who or what age we find to be, sexually attractive, there may be something biological that is going on. I wouldn't necessarily say it's an evolutionary process. So Michael Seto's got an idea of chronophilias, and he sets out basically an age-graded theory of sexual interest, so that you can span, your sexual interest essentially can span from nepiophilia, which is a sexual attraction towards essentially infants or babies, all the way through to gerontophilia, which would be a sexual attraction towards very, very old people. But most people seem to be teleophiles, who are those who are attracted to, sexually mature adults above the age of 18, for example. But again, around that kind of young teleophilic age, you've got ephebophiles, who are attracted to sexually mature adolescents. There may be some kind of evolutionary thing going on there. I wouldn't want to say either way, to be honest. But it is important to acknowledge that people are attracted to different age categories, I suppose. Whether or not that's an evolutionary mechanism or an evolutionary process, I'm not convinced, and I've not seen any of the evidence to support that idea.
So, and again, this is the age-old question. You can't do this, but if we were to strip a person from their cultural society, would we expect to see them be attracted to someone at appropriate age or hitting puberty? Or, you know, I guess the question is it a psychopathology because it's a socially constructed psychopathology, as in we don't find it acceptable because we want to protect people? Or is it an evolutionary perspective or biological perspective, in terms of, well, if you remove society, well then, who knows what will really happen?
I'm not sure you can separate the two. I'm not sure you can separate the social construct of, or the social environment of, what do we see as being appropriate in terms of sexual activity. You would expect, if there were no laws, assuming an evolutionary approach, you would expect people to be reproducing or attracted to those who are of a fertile age, who are able to raise children. Again, I wouldn't want to go into too much detail in terms of evolutionary psychology because my ignorance will shine through rather quickly. But yeah, I'm not sure you can separate the social environment from what we see as being appropriate sexually.
Interesting, because some people, I guess some cultures, you know, with child brides and things like that, where they don't seem to have too much of an issue with marrying or becoming wedlocked to someone much younger than what in the Western society we would consider appropriate. And so I guess, you know, naturally, where did it come about, this idea of what was an appropriate age and not an appropriate age? And is it somehow linked into sexual offending or paedophilia or psychopathology?
I think the idea of societies with particularly very young child brides might have something more to do with the context in which those I wouldn't necessarily want to call them marriages, but what those interactions are taking place in. I don't think there would be any evolutionary or I don't think there would be any utility in having those types of relationships. It seems more of an ownership idea for me for those types of relationships. It would be less in terms of sexual attraction and more in terms of ownership. From my perspective, that may be wrong.
And I guess also it would be a purity thing as well.
In what sense?
In the sense that, you know, in certain cultures, the idea of the virgin bride is particularly held in high esteem. And so I'm assuming, therefore, that the ownership here with the youth, and the youth is symbolic of being a virgin and all that stuff, it must be interlinked.
Yeah, so the idea of purity there would definitely standard, but again that would stem from the cultural perspective of what should a bride be like when she's married.
Just to ask quickly whilst I'm here, it is the idea of sexual offending of children or even the sexual attraction to children, is there purity involved in that for the large part?
From the offender's perspective?
Yeah, a thing that they find particularly attractive or compelling?
I've not seen any research to suggest that, no. So much of the research tends to focus around either sexual attraction or some kind of cognitive distortion or something called emotional congruence, where you are kind of more in sync, I suppose, with children than you are with adults.
Right, okay, because obviously from a psychological perspective, we must be the only species that is interested in purity and the idea of virginity. And it made me wonder about the whole sexual offending for children, if there was some kind of strange, bizarre link. Why has it survived so long in our gene pool? And why do we still have people attracted to children if it was evolutionary, not adaptable, presumably punished in societies or cultures or tribes? It's interesting to think it still goes on.
Yeah, so I suppose we're getting to the definition of what actually is paedophilia. So paedophilia, if we're just going to define it for everyone, is the sexual interest, or some people are now starting to call it sexual orientation, that is directed towards prepubescent children, typically below the age of 11 or 12 perhaps. But it's where your sexual interest is consistent, it's predominant, or it's exclusive towards that group. In terms of what actually causes it, though, in terms of it being biological, so the way you phrase it is it an evolutionary thing? Why would it have survived? I'm not sure that it's necessarily an adaptive biological function. It might be a something that happens in utero that stops or impedes some kind of neurological development. So James Cant has done a hell of a lot of work looking at the biological basis of paedophilia, looking specifically at aspects of the brain. And he's found a lot of stuff that differentiates paedophiles from non-paedophiles in the brain. Just talking biologically, paedophiles typically are around 2.5 centimeters shorter than non-paedophiles. They're significantly more left-handed than non-paedophiles. These are kind of things that are driven by the brain. So handedness in particular is something that's driven by something that's going on in the brain, what side of the brain is more dominant than the other. So there's clearly something biologically going on. In terms of structures, though, there doesn't seem to be any difference in terms of brain structure between paedophiles and non-paedophiles, at least not in what's called the grey matter. So the grey matter is kind of the structural aspects, the cortex, the structures within the brain, essentially. But what Cantor and his colleagues have found is that there's differences in the white matter of paedophiles' brains as compared to non-paedophiles. And this might be symptomatic of some kind of cross-wiring in the brain. I know it's not necessarily a scientific way of putting it, but some kind of thing where when a paedophile sees a child, instead of triggering some kind of nurturing response, it triggers more of a sexual response. So there's something neurologically going on in paedophiles' brains that involves a whole network of structures that are involved with the processing of sexual stimuli. I don't think it's a biological construct from the perspective of evolution, but there may be something that happens that disrupts normal brain development as a baby is developing in the womb.
If it is something that develops in the womb, is it possible to also say where the research is heading towards? Is there a strong developmental process to this in terms of outside the womb, the environment that person grows up in? Do we know if there's any facts or figures around that?
It's a good question. What Cantor's team has found is that those who are paedophiles tend to have more incidents of things like traumatic brain injury before the onset of puberty. So there may be something that happens before puberty. But once you hit puberty, your sexual interest or your sexual orientation typically is relatively fixed. So if something does happen, then it would be before puberty. But to be honest, the evidence on neurological development and differences in the brain is not enough to necessarily diagnose paedophilia in an individual person, but you do see quite big differences between groups, so between paedophiles and non-paedophiles. So in terms of can you develop paedophilia after you've been born, I'm not convinced. I'm not saying that it wouldn't necessarily be something that you can do, but I don't think the evidence is as strong as the biological evidence.
That brings me to this level of skepticism regarding treatment protocols when, if we look at it from a purely biological, essentially you're born this way. I guess a lot of people would be like, well, if it's set in stone, as it were, what do you want us to do about it?
Well, that depends on how you conceptualise paedophilia. So if you conceptualise paedophilia as a sexual orientation in the same way that heterosexuality maybe is, you wouldn't condemn all heterosexual men as being rapists. You would, in the same way that you wouldn't necessarily condemn all paedophiles as being child molesters. If you do conflate paedophilia with child sexual abuse, then clearly that is an argument that you would be able to make. I'm not convinced that the evidence would be on that particular side, though.
So just to specify what you mean, making a distinction between sexual offenders and paedophiles.
Yes. So we know that there are a large number of paedophiles who don't commit any sexual offences, and we also know that many child sexual offenders against children are not actually paedophilic. So there was a study that was done just a couple of years ago where a team in Germany essentially took a sample of child sexual offenders and looked at their sexual interests using something called the ISIP, which looks at both explicit, so self-reported sexual interest, and implicit measures of sexual interest, looking at kind of response times, viewing times. They looked at phallometric assessment as well, so where you essentially look at how physiologically men respond to sexual stimuli or non-sexual stimuli. And what they found was that fewer than 50% of the child sexual offenders in that sample were actually diagnosable, if you want to use that term, as being paedophiles. So obviously that means that just over 50% were not paedophilic. So they were offending for other reasons rather than paedophilia. There's definitely a distinction to be made. So some estimates put the rates of paedophilia or the prevalence of paedophilia up at around 5% of the general population, particularly in men, that is. But we also see that a large proportion of men will report some kind of sexual interest in children. So up to 20% in some German samples report some degree of sexual interest. So basically this is where you show people a picture of a child and say, how sexually arousing is this picture? And they say anything other than zero, not at all sexually arousing. Up to 20% will score somewhere above that zero. Are we saying that all of those 20% are A, paedophiles, and B, child molesters? I don't think it would be sensible to suggest that.
It sounds like you're making an argument for like a scale in terms of, you know, I guess if you have enough of these traits or attributes, you find children sexually attractive, and then it decreases until you don't find children sexually attractive and you find adults sexually attractive.
No, I wouldn't necessarily say that. So there has been some work done quite recently, and I think it's still unpublished, so I haven't seen the exact data yet. But what you can do is you can do something that's called a taxometric analysis on different groups. So you can see basically, are people divisible into what's called a taxon, so a specific kind of discrete category of person, or is a behaviour on some kind of spectrum? So what you've just described would be the view of paedophilia being on a spectrum where you are either truly paedophilic or truly teleophilic, maybe. But I think, and again, I haven't seen this data, so I may be getting this slightly wrong, but the most recent kind of rumours that I've heard is that in Canada they've done some work looking at this taxometric analysis of paedophiles, and they've found that there are three different taxons. So those who are only interested in children, people who are interested in adults, and those who are interested in both, or people who are more fluid in that sexual interest. So I think there is something taxometric, for want of a slightly less scientific word, going on with paedophilia. I don't think it's a true spectrum there.
You made like a parallel earlier about comparing paedophilia with sexual offender with being a heterosexual and rape. Do you think that's like a fair comparison that you're comfortable with or not?
Personally, I'm quite comfortable with that comparison. I think there's clearly more risk if you are paedophilic than if you're just kind of your standard telophilic heterosexual guy. Inherently with that sexual interest, your targets, or the targets of your sexual interest, are much more vulnerable than a heterosexual adult male's targets are. But at the same time, we know that not all paedophiles are child molesters, and not all child molesters are paedophiles, in the same way that we know that not all heterosexual males are rapists. I can see why people have an issue with that comparison. But again, that probably ties into the conflation between paedophilia and child sexual abuse, and B, the emotional response that we have, not only to sexual offending, but to the paedophile label as well.
Yeah, which what we were talking about in the beginning. I have to ask one thing before I forget to mention it. Is it mostly a male thing?
Yes, yeah. The rates of female paedophilia, I've not actually seen any real estimates. The vast majority, though, I would say probably over 95% would be males. Obviously, we know that women do commit sexual offences against children, but typically they are working with male kind of co-offenders, and they are the ones who typically are paedophilic rather than the females within that group.
This is going to be really speculative, but do you have a hypothesis as to why that might be?
Quite honestly, no. There may be some kind of, speaking quite ignorantly, there may be some kind of evolutionary perspective on that, in that we know that males tend to be interested across and down, typically in the age and the status hierarchy, whereas women are across and up. Yeah, that would be pure speculation on my part, though.
It's a difficult and hard question to ask and answer, really. And it brings up some uncomfortable points. Why would it be so heavily male dominated?
Yeah, and again, I don't think there isn't an answer at the moment. I'm not sure that people have really asked that question in terms of what's driving the effect of sex on non-celiophilic sexual interests. It'd be an interesting PhD project, perhaps.
I think if you could answer that one, you'd know a hell of a lot more about it in general.
I think so.
That would be like one of the last questions to get answered, because you're trying to find out more important stuff.
Yeah, and it would definitely tap into this idea of there being some kind of biological aspect to it. So whether it is purely biological or whether it's driven by some kind of evolutionary process, it would tap into the idea of being a biological rather than a learnt behaviour or a learnt interest.
So, you know, I guess what the really difficult part of the conversation would be, are you suggesting then that people who classify as paedophiles, can they control their behaviour, curb it in some way?
I think so, yeah. So we know that not all paedophiles will commit sexual offences. There's online communities, so you've probably heard of the Virtuous Paedophiles Forum. You know that there are people on Twitter who are openly identifying as anti-contact paedophiles, so people who are interested in sexually interested in children but actively work to not offend against children and work to help those who are interested in children to abstain from that sexual behaviour. Absolutely, I believe that people who have that sexual interest can control their behaviour. I think to say otherwise would be quite demeaning to them, to be honest, to say that they have some kind of lack of self-control that we don't as non-paedophiles. I think we need to have as much respect for them as we do for other people, if not even more, because what they're essentially doing is living their lives in total celibacy and quite often quite unhappily, which I don't think people really think about in this kind of situation.
Well, we're talking about being able to abstain from sex, basically. Do you think that's something that many people can do in society, regardless of your sexual orientation or interest? Do you feel like that's an easy thing for anyone to do?
Well, we're not talking about abstaining from any form of sexual activity. We're talking about abstaining from sexual activity with another person that they may be primarily sexually attracted to. There's nothing stopping them. And again, this is quite an uncomfortable topic for people to think about. But obviously, those people who are sexually interested in children will still have things like sexual fantasies. They will still engage in masturbation. These are kind of sexual activities. These can be outlets for sexual activity or sexual urges that can still act as a normal form of sexual outlet, even if they can't enact that sexuality with someone that they are actually interested in or sexually aroused by. I think, again, these are typically men who know that they can't engage in sexual activity with someone who they are sexually aroused by or sexually attracted to. And I think if they do that, if they actively work to protect children, then they deserve our respect and they deserve our admiration in some way.
Do you you mentioned other outlets. Are you also referring to just having sex with someone who isn't a child?
In terms of, what do you mean? In terms of, so people who are paedophilic having sexual relationships with adults?
Yeah, for example, yeah.
Yeah, so that is something that does happen. So paedophilia is the primary or exclusive sexual interest. So it doesn't have to be an exclusive sexual interest. So people can be aroused by, for example, adult women and very young girls or very young boys even. That isn't unheard of. It's relatively common, actually, in terms of paedophilic sexual interest. It will be a sexual interest that is in addition to some other sexual arousal pattern.
Okay, so it's not often just primarily just children.
Well, often it is, but there are I wouldn't want to say it's more or less than half, because I'm not sure exactly what it is, but there would be a sizable proportion of paedophiles who are also attracted to people who would be above the age of consent.
Just trying to put this into perspective in terms of how successful they would be in terms of abstaining for long periods of time or lifelong. If we were just to compare them to someone who was a heterosexual and they were told they couldn't have sex with women, and the only way to get that out would be either masturbation or sleeping with someone who isn't a woman. So in this case, I guess it would be another man. Do you feel like that's a fair comparison?
Not necessarily in this situation, no, because you would still have... they would presumably still have a sexual interest in the partner that they're with. So if their sexual interest in children is the primary sexual interest, then that still does mean that they have some sexual interest in adult women, for example. So you would still have some kind of sexual interest or sexual interaction with the person that you were with. It wouldn't be a case of saying, I'm a paedophile, but I'm going to be with you for the purposes of coming across as being a telophilic adult male. It wouldn't be essentially a show relationship. It would be a real relationship still. But it would just be with that added layer of knowledge, or maybe even a lack of knowledge from the partner, that the male in that relationship is also interested in children.
It sounds then like you're comparing it more to bisexuals.
No, I wouldn't go that far. No, I don't think that's... I think it's a case of people have different sexual interests. I'm not sure how to respond to that, to be honest.
Well, I'm just trying to follow the logic out. So if we're saying it's not equivalent to a heterosexual abstaining, having to be homosexual or celibacy completely, and we're not saying that it's the same as being attracted to both men and women, so then, okay, you could, say, form a long-term partnership with a woman, but you're still interested in men, and your partner is aware of that. If it's not any of those two, are we saying it's somewhere in the middle?
Potentially. But again, it might be the case that, say, for example, if a telophilic adult male was in a relationship and he found obviously his partner is sexually attractive, but also he found if he was in his 40s, he might still find 20-year-olds sexually attractive as well. It would be that kind of idea of he's attracted to his partner because that's kind of an age-appropriate sexual target, but also he's interested in another age category. So this is where we would refer back to Sito's chronophilia model. So your sexual orientation in terms of for gender, and this is where I think we're maybe getting a little bit confused. So the gender orientation would remain the same, but the chronophilic or the age orientation would be something that is more fluid, I suppose. Does that make more sense?
I guess the thing is we keep running into the problem of the social cutoff period where it's acceptable and not acceptable, and if that passes a threshold naturally in our evolution or in terms of just natural human behaviour, or if it's merely a socially constructed and therefore it's meaningless outside of our societal norms.
Yeah, so I think we do obviously have that arbitrary cutoff of the age of consent, and it's something that is inherently a conceptual issue in how we conceptualise childhood in... I mean, I don't know what it's like in... You're in Australia, aren't you?
Yeah.
I don't know what it's like in Australia in terms of the distinction between when you can be tried for a criminal offence versus when you can give sexual consent versus when you can... I don't know, when you can start paying taxes, when you can join the army. I mean, we've got this bizarre situation in the UK where you can consent to... you can consent to have sex at the age of 16, but if you take a picture of yourself at 16 having sex, then you've made an abusive image of a child. There seems to be a very arbitrary and confused approach to how we conceptualise childhood that I'm observing, but I'm not qualified to really comment on where that arbitrary cutoff should be. But
sure.
Almost inevitably, we run into the case of it's... It is going to be an arbitrary cutoff based on our best guess or the best available evidence at the time.
I guess it really boils down to, do you see it in terms of natural and unnatural? Is it, you know, 60 or 70 years ago, maybe less than that, homosexuality was considered unnatural and still is by some people, some demographic. Do you think we're in a phase now where we're just simply seeing it in those terms because of our lack of understanding of it, i.e. it's unnatural? Or do you think there is something behind this that would be permanently understanding it as a natural sexual response?
I think it's a difficult question to answer because you've got different uses of the word natural that come up in that. So if you're using natural in terms of normal or adaptive or pure, then you would make, well, those who say that paedophilia or even homosexuality is unnatural would be making that argument. I would say that's probably an example of the naturalistic fallacy, where people are calling something unnatural because they don't like it. I would say that paedophilia is natural in terms of it naturally is appearing in society. That doesn't mean that I necessarily would like to see more people expressing their paedophilia. But having that distinction between natural and okay, or natural and acceptable, I think is something that we haven't really grappled with in terms of our response. We just say something like, paedophilia, that's disgusting and it's unnatural. It's not natural because it's disgusting. Whereas actually it's natural because it occurs, irrespective of what your emotional response to it is.
So I guess then we're looking at more of a clinical perspective in terms of it naturally occurs in people, albeit a small percentage of people. And yep. We have to look at it in terms of the clinical population. Is that, would you agree that this is a clinical subset population in which by it's not useful to them or society? They can't really function in society adequately without some kind of intervention?
I think that's probably true for a large proportion. I don't think that every person who has a paedophilic sexual interest will need some kind of intervention if they have some kind of social support in place. So this is why the Virtuous Paedophiles community online is so important, I think. They offer support to each other. They truly understand what's going on in terms of the sexual interest. But at the same time, we should have these support services in place for them. So things like the Dunkelfeld project in Germany, where paedophiles can come forward and they can then access anonymous help, anonymous support, anonymous therapy that helps them to live an offence-free life while still acknowledging that they have this sexual interest that probably isn't changeable. So yeah, I think in terms of that sense, it could be seen as a clinical issue. Obviously in the DSM it is classified as a paraphilia or a sexual disorder when it causes harm or distress to the person who is experiencing it. So you can be a paedophile without being a clinical patient, but if it's causing you distress, which clearly is the case for a substantial number of people with paedophilic sexual interests, that is when it would become more of a clinical issue.